desk. As he made his way around the room, Mr. Tatnall, their teacher, nodded approvingly and complimented Maria on having such neat handwriting, a skill that was highly valued by the faculty at Queen of Angels, and then announced to the class that it was nearly time to go home, that anything that remained to be done would have to be finished on their own time. Melanie, Teresa, and a girl named Janice Davies converged as they made their way toward her swiftly, catching her as she walked toward her locker to retrieve her coat.
"Are you going home now?" said Teresa,
and when she nodded, the three of them followed Ada out the door without a word, as if they had made some collective decision in advance, without informing her of it. It was colder out that week than it had been, and the weather reminded her often of David, whose favorite season was approaching. She and her classmates walked together, the other girls laughing at this or that, impersonating their teachers, a favorite pastime, or other children in their grade. At times, they shrieked so loudly that it stopped Ada's heart. She could not get used to this fact about girls her own age, their volume, their exuberance, the outlandishness of their humor, the way they invented wild, improbable scenarios in their heads and then speculated about enacting them, the silliness of them, the sheer joyful foolishness, except when they were around boys. When they were around boys, they reduced themselves, their voices, their bodies, made them smaller, making way for the male antics that occupied a place of precedence in the center of any room. Ada could barely keep up with their swinging, shifting moods. They seemed to her like birds in flight, like starlings, changing direction with such collective, unspoken force that it seemed as if they shared a central root system, a pine barren joined together invisibly beneath the earth. Ada did not know where any of them lived. She had never been to their homes, but she had heard vaguely that Melanie and Teresa lived on the same block, a nice one near the school, with well-kept houses. She began to worry, therefore, when they continued to walk with Ada past where she thought they might have turned off. At some point, her three companions lapsed into first silence, then whispers. They walked a step behind her. Ada knew then, had known in a way since they left the school, that their plan was to meet William by shadowing her home, but she was uncertain how to stop it. She checked her watch. It was nearly 5 o'clock. William wouldn't be home yet anyway. He rarely came home before 7 or 8 in the evening. This knowledge made her smug. She would say nothing, she decided. She would not try to stop them coming with her, only feign ignorance about their intentions when they all arrived at Liston's house together. Gregory was in the front yard when she arrived, and at the sight of the four of them, he darted quickly onto the porch and then into the house. Ada wondered briefly whether he thought about Melanie McCarthy the way she thought about William Liston, and then decided that the answer was probably yes.
"Hey, Gregory,"
Teresa called after him, a sing-song tone in her voice that Ada recognized as mocking in some way. There was a pause.
"This is me,"
she said then, turning to face them at last. The three of them stood there silently, exchanging glances out of the corners of their eyes for a pause, until Teresa, the bravest, finally spoke up.
"Can we come in?"
she asked. Ada was about to tell her something, that Maddie was sick, that Liston needed quiet for her work, when Liston herself came out onto the porch, startling her. She was not normally home so early.
"Hi, girls," she said brightly. "Ada, are these your friends?"
Ada could see a look in her eyes that signified to her profound happiness and surprise, that Ada was standing there in a group of such pretty, normal-looking peers. And perhaps the recognition of an opening, a new point of entry, a way to thaw the coldness that Ada had been directing at her for weeks. Teresa nodded.
"Hi, Miss Liston," she said.
Liston descended from the porch and walked toward them on the little brick path to the sidewalk. The lawn had not been mowed in quite some time.
Liston was wearing a sort of windbreaker suit, the kind she wore whenever she was not at the lab. Shiny, baggy, hot pink pants with a matching zip-up jacket. Her hair was large that day. She had just gotten it permed. In retrospect, the outfit was absurd. And yet later, Ada could recall feeling, against her will, grateful for Liston. For her normalcy. For the fact that she looked, presumably, like all of their mothers. The fact that she was the same age, had the same accent. She was nothing like David, whose shabby clothes and long, quick stride, whose obliviousness to those around him, had caused Ada such shame the day he came to meet her after school. Liston in her pink tracksuit made her feel, for the first time in her life, as if she belonged. She asked for all of their names, and then asked Janice Davies if her mother wasn't Nancy Davies, who used to be Nancy Hill. Janice nodded, and it was then that Liston put her hands together as if she had just come up with an idea.
"Can you stay for dinner, girls?"
she asked them all, and they looked at each other, and then at Ada.
"I can cook for once,"
said Liston, beaming at Ada, telling Ada with her expression that she was proud of her, that she was on her side. It was clear to Ada that Liston thought she was doing her a favor, that this was part of Liston's ongoing plan to win back Ada's trust. While the girls called their mothers, Ada and Liston stood in the kitchen together. "They seem nice," said Liston hopefully. Ada was alert now, listening for other sounds in the house. She wanted to ask Liston who else was home, but she couldn't think of a way to. Instead, she excused herself to go upstairs briefly and sighed in relief when she passed William's room and found it empty, the door ajar. They made it all the way through dinner without William returning. Liston made spaghetti from a box and tomato sauce from a jar and heated up some frozen broccoli florets she found at the back of her freezer. Maddie ate it all enthusiastically, exclaiming sweetly that he thought it was delicious. He may have. He may also have been happy to have his mother cook anything at all. Gregory ate quietly at the table, avoiding eye contact with everyone. Especially, thought Ada, Melanie McCarthy. Liston, meanwhile, bonded instantly with all three girls, talking to them about their parents, their neighborhood, their houses, their siblings. They were talkative and eager with her, polite but outspoken. They had an easy way with Liston that made her jealous. They teased her a bit, and Liston howled with laughter in response. These, Ada thought, were girls that reminded Liston of her own daughter. They were not serious like Ada, not quiet and severe.
"Let's see what I can find for dessert," said Liston. "Come and help me, Ada."
Ada followed Liston to the kitchen, where Liston produced from her freezer a half-empty gallon of slightly frost-burned Neapolitan ice cream, and asked Ada to get out some bowls and spoons.
"They seem like such nice girls," said Liston, smiling at her. "You know, you can invite them over any time, baby."
Ada wanted to tell Liston what she knew to be true, that these girls were not here for Ada, not really, that their aim was higher. Instead, she said thank you. At 8 o'clock in the evening, Ada checked her watch and began to worry about William's return. Liston and the other girls were still talking quickly and loudly. The girls were divulging what they knew about the children of Liston's acquaintances in the neighborhood.
"I always knew he'd turn out to be a bad apple," said Liston, or, "sounds like a mother."
Abruptly, Ada stood up from the table. They looked at her.
"I guess it's that time," said Liston after a pause.
She hugged the girls goodbye, and Ada walked with them out onto the porch. And it was then, of course it was then, that she saw William Liston's long, ambling body come striding up the street in the early dark. If she had been by herself, she would have turned back inside and gone quickly into another room. That was what she normally did. But now she couldn't, because all four of them together had seen him. Teresa stuck an elbow into Melanie's ribs, and Melanie lurched to the side. Here was the moment Ada had been waiting for, dreading, and yet the fact that it was happening gave her almost a feeling of relief. To be so thoroughly undone. To be so caught. William turned up the brick pathway toward the house, and his step hitched a bit when he saw them. Ada took in a deep breath.
"Hey, Will," she said,
the first time she had ever used his nickname, perhaps the first time she had ever called him directly by name.
"Hi," he said uncertainly.
She felt feverish with nerves. She was lit only by the dim porch light, a naked bulb attended by dozens of moths.
"These are my friends," she continued. "Teresa, Janice, Melanie."
"Hey," said William again.
And he walked forward again, toward their little group, and seemed almost about to let himself in the door, until he stopped near Melanie, on his right, and turned to her.
"I know you," he said. "I've seen you at school before."
Melanie, in the porch light, looked even more angelic than usual. Her long hair silky, golden, the color of grain, her face upturned, her sleepy eyes wide open.
"What's your name again?" asked William.
"Melanie," she said.
"Melanie McCarthy," said William. "I've heard about you." "All good things," he added. "Don't worry."
Then he winked at her. Suddenly the memory of the same gesture in Ada's direction felt unimportant in comparison, and walked inside.
"Night, Ada," he said to her, before he left.
Within 2 weeks, William and Melanie were dating. Within a month, Melanie had replaced Karen as another presence in Liston's home, and Liston's approval of her as Ada's friend had turned to a kind of wary acceptance of her as William's girlfriend. "She's awfully young, William," Ada overheard her say to him once.
"She's in high school, Mom," said William,
and Liston replied to him that freshmen and seniors were at very different stages in their lives.
"Just don't get into any trouble," said Liston. "Promise."
Ada's friendship with Melanie, with all of them, remained superficially intact. When she came to Liston's house, the two of them would chat. Sometimes Janice and Teresa would come along as well, and then they would all spend time together. But mainly Melanie spent time with William, in his room, with the door open, at Liston's insistence. Sometimes Ada was shocked that these girls had hatched a plan and enacted it so successfully, had gotten exactly what they had set out to get. In another way, it confirmed for her that there was a sort of justice in the world. Beautiful people made up their minds to achieve something, and then achieved it. It was natural, orderly. There was logic in it. She shared David's abstract appreciation of attractive people as aesthetic objects, though she tempered this by maintaining, like him, a feeling of intellectual superiority over them, a satisfying conviction that she was in some way abstemious and therefore holy. And the fact of Melanie's dating William didn't crush her the way she thought it might. Instead, it brought Ada several degrees closer to him than she had been, and for this she was perversely grateful to Melanie. Spending more time with William revealed something to Ada, that he wasn't unintelligent. He could be funny and dry when he wanted to be. He had some of Liston's good nature, though he also had a dose of Gregory's spitefulness, often getting angry with his mother for reasons that seemed small and insignificant to Ada. He asked Ada what she thought of things, at times, and listened to her answers in a way that felt genuine. Once, speaking to Melanie, he said about Ada,
"She's funny,"
tipping his head toward her as if Ada weren't in the room with them. Melanie had no more to say now than she did before they had gotten together. Mainly, she sat quietly as Ada and William talked, and with her large eyes, she tracked all of William's movements, mimicking him subtly with her own. Shortly after Melanie and William began dating, and with a certain amount of shame, Ada began to go without her glasses whenever it was possible, donning them only when she needed to read something on the board. Her eyesight wasn't terrible. She could see well to a distance of 10 feet, more than enough to read the facial expressions of others near her, but not quite enough to recognize a friend at the end of a hallway.
"Did you get contacts?"
asked Teresa, and she told her that she had.
"You look way better like that,"
she said. Ada carried this half-compliment inside her chest for weeks afterward, letting it fill her with shameful pride. By mid-November, Ron Loughner had produced no further information about David, no clues about his past or his identity, no information about why he might have been reported missing, nor about why Caltech had no record of him as a student. Neither had Ada. Twice Liston had timidly broached the subject of her father with her, and each time Ada had cut her off. She was not interested in Liston's theories on why David might have lied.
"Been dishonest," Liston corrected herself quickly. "Been misguided."
"He wasn't," Ada said sharply, and walked out of the room. She caught a glimpse of Liston's expression before she left. It was wounded, collapsed, her mouth slightly open, her hands entwined, frozen mid-gesture. Despite her loyalty to David, she began to see him less. Her visits with him saddened her. They felt unproductive and disturbing. She had failed to mention this to Liston, who, she imagined, assumed that Ada was still visiting her father after school each day. A year ago, Ada would have felt guilty about deceiving her. But the mistrust that had settled in her heart when it came to Liston allowed her to justify her actions to herself. She did not owe anything to Liston, thought Ada. During her newly free afternoons, Ada had begun to visit the library branch that she and David used to frequent, where their favorite librarian, Anna Holmes, still worked. Miss Holmes had not heard anything about Ada's father's decline and assumed that he was still as he always was, living at home, working at the Steiner lab. There was something so comforting about her presence, a reminder of Ada's past, that she did not correct Miss Holmes on this point. Instead, when she walked into the library, she allowed herself to slip back in time, and a calm happiness washed over her, and Miss Holmes beamed in greeting. She was a lovely woman, tall and elegant, with hair that was blonde and gray together, and a smile that sent lines down her cheeks from the corners of her eyes.
"That is a person who is good at her job,"
David had said to Ada once, respectfully, about Miss Holmes. Now she asked after David often, betraying a subtle disappointment that he no longer came in to see her. Once or twice she even sent Ada home with something for him, a new book that she thought he would enjoy, or once, a jar of sauce that she had cooked and canned from tomatoes she grew in her garden in Ashmont. Ada accepted all of these gifts for David, assuring herself that one day she would tell Miss Holmes the truth. In the meantime, she allowed herself this respite, this brief calm in her otherwise uneasy existence. Without David there to guide what she would read, Ada had begun to read other sorts of books. She had stalled on the marble composition books that he had filled with the titles of novels, biographies, theorems, concepts. It all felt untrustworthy now. In the light of all his betrayal, how could she be certain that his recommendations were worthwhile? Instead, in her bedroom, she read bad books she found at Liston's house, including a dirty one with a heroine in a torn dress on its cover. Liston had a stack of these books in plain sight on her bedside table. And at the library, Ada now read books for teenage girls that her friends at school liked. Sweet Valley High, Flowers in the Attic, books by Michael McDowell and Frank Belknap Long with gruesome covers that made her afraid to be alone in the dark. Her favorites were books called the Tina Marie series, about teenage girls in a pop band, books that she would never have read in front of David. With a certain sinking feeling, she realized she had no reason to hide them any longer. Each morning when she woke, she thought about going to visit David, and then quailed. She could not bear it. The thought of looking at his blank countenance with so many unanswered questions between them. She felt she did not know him. Some nights, unable to bear her loneliness, she called his hospital room in the hope of hearing his voice. But always, always she hung up after one ring before he answered. She had terrible dreams of his death, woke up crying and guilt-stricken, vowed to go see him. But the truth, when she allowed herself to think it, was that she was afraid. And the longer she waited, the more afraid she became of seeing him. Who would be there in his room, in his chair when she arrived? David might be gone, spirited away, she thought. And there, in his place, some changeling. Liston still went to visit him every Sunday after church. When she asked Ada if she wanted to come, Ada made up the same excuse. She'd seen him all week, she said, and she had too much homework. At last, one Friday, Ron Loughner called Liston to tell her he had new information for them, and Liston was careful to let Ada know right away. He came over that evening to present it, looking proud of himself, smug in a way that Ada did not like. He had been recommended to Liston by a friend on the police force, but Ada could tell that even she found him grating, maybe somewhat incompetent. She had hoped that Melanie and William would not be home for this, and she was relieved that the house was still empty when Loughner arrived. Even Maddie was out at a friend's house for dinner. The three of them sat at the kitchen table. Liston asked if anyone wanted a drink, and Ron Loughner asked for a Coca-Cola. Ada had a vague suspicion that he was a recovering alcoholic.
I only have diet, said Liston, and he said that would be fine.
He produced a manila folder with paperwork neatly stacked inside and opened it. From it, he removed a photocopied list of Sebelius births and deaths in New York over the course of the last century.
The extended Sebelius family is getting smaller by the decade, he began. At the beginning of the century, there were a huge presence in New York. Lots of cousins, lots of branches. In the 1920s, 30s, Sebelius was like Astor or Carnegie. You couldn't throw a stone without hitting one of them at some society function. But by now, a lot of the branches have died out. They weren't a particularly fertile bunch, I guess, he said, pleased with this turn of phrase.
He took a sip of his Diet Coke. He continued,
by now, anybody with the last name Sebelius has moved elsewhere. And they're mainly cousins, second cousins twice removed from John Fairfax and Isabel Sebelius, he said, naming David's parents. One of the first things I did when I took on the case was try to find any living Sebelius to tell me why David's family would have reported him missing.
They were estranged, Ada said quickly. David didn't speak to them. Loughner paused for a moment, regarding Ada with something she suspected was sympathy, and then continued.
Recently, I found one living relative, he said. Isabel's younger half-sister, much younger, Ellen Palmer. She lives now in Burlington, Vermont. She's 74 years old. Same father, different mother. She wasn't close to Isabel, but she visited New York every Christmas as a child until she was 18 or so. She would only have been 14 years older than David, said Loughner, and therefore he presumably would have still been in the house when she visited.
He paused for a moment, letting the weight of his statement settle over the room.
She says the Sebelius son disappeared at 17, he said, finally, placing a palm delicately on the table. And only resurfaced when he was a legal adult, at which point he indicated, by mail, that he did not want anything to do with them. The case was closed legally, but they never saw him again.
That makes sense, said Ada, looking at Liston for validation. That's what David said happened. She was beginning to feel uplifted, Perhaps this had been simply a misunderstanding. Liston avoided her gaze.
She also gave us a picture of David, said Loughner.
He reached again into the manila folder and produced a large-scale photograph that he observed himself before sliding it across the table to them.
Alan Palmer says this is her nephew at 16, said Loughner.
Ada pulled the picture toward her. In it were two people. One was a young woman, pretty, stout, with a high collar and a short, fashionable haircut. Ellen Palmer, perhaps. The other was a slender, sensitive-looking boy, wearing a tie and a scowl. The boy had blonde hair, a slightly upturned nose, large, dark eyes. He also had a birthmark, a small mole in the middle of his right cheek. She turned the picture over. On the back was written in beautiful old-fashioned handwriting, E. Palmer, D. G. Sebelius, 1941. This was not David. This was not her father. Liston took the photograph from her. Ada looked back and forth between them, Liston and Loughner.
I don't understand, she said.
Loughner paused.
It seems likely, he said finally, that your father was not a Sebelius.
Maybe she's lying. Maybe she's just afraid we're going to come after her money, said Ada.
But she doubted this as she said it.
I'm not sure what to say, said Loughner.
The room was very silent. Ada felt his gaze upon her, and the gaze of Liston, who did not seem surprised. It was not a surprise to Ada either. It felt more like an awakening, a letting go. Her identity as a Sebelius had been integral to her understanding of herself. Although David was disparaging of his family and of their outdated restrictive belief system, he also seemed to find a sort of dignity in belonging to such an established lineage. His identity seemed to be comprised equally of pride in his ancestry and pride in his rejection of it. He had very effectively transferred this pride to Ada. It was what she fell back on, in this new unplanned chapter of her life, when she had nothing else to be proud of. Now she was not certain what she had left to take pride in. Not even David anymore. For she no longer knew who he was. Ada gathered all the scraps of her 14-year-old self-possession, and she asked Ron Loughner very politely whether he had been able to determine anything further about David's identity.
Not yet, said Loughner. Now we know who he wasn't, if you know what I mean. We still have to figure out who he was.
Thank you,
said Ada with dignity. Then she excused herself carefully from the table and walked down the hallway toward the stairs.
Ada?
Liston called after her. But she didn't stop. At 7 o'clock, Liston knocked gently on her door and called to her through it, asking if she wanted dinner. Ada declined. She couldn't eat. She felt incorporeal. She felt she had been cut adrift from everything on Earth. She felt as if she were floating, untethered in the atmosphere. Formerly fond memories of David now presented themselves to her, one after another, as something painful. Here was David, in his apron, in the kitchen. David listening to his records, head lowered to his hand in contemplation. David bouncing excitedly on his toes, delivering the news of some discovery, or of a new friend, or of the engagement of a friend, or acquaintance, or a grad student at the lab. He was deeply, unexpectedly romantic. He loved weddings. He loved surprise engagements and hearing the stories of proposals.
And did he take a knee?
Ada heard him ask a former postdoc Sheila once, subsequently expressing great approval that her fiancé had done so. Perhaps her favorite memories of him, the ones that now drifted toward her from the other side of sleep, were of their trips to the mountains. David had rented the same cabin in the Adirondacks every July since he was in his 30s, and each summer the two of them went there all 4 weekends, and sometimes he brought his colleagues, too, for work retreats. It was a simple wooden cottage, with very tall pine trees all around it, and a set of wooden stairs leading down to a little lake 10 miles up the north way from Lake George. David always got off the highway early to drive through Lake George Village, which had a main street lined with kitsch of various kinds, giant friendly lumberjack statues made out of something like papier-mâché, outsized teepees with arrow signs pointing inward, advertising authentic Indian apparel, Viking-themed miniature golf courses, a wax museum with a window display featuring Frankenstein playing the organ. David was delighted by it all, and often insisted on stopping in to one or another of these local attractions. Together they saw the diving horse at Storytown, when Ada was too old for such things, simply because they had never before seen it, and David had decided it was time. Dutifully, she wandered into and out of souvenir shops that by the 1980s sold mainly t-shirts with terrible jokes on them. Often they stopped for dinner on the way at one of a handful of restaurants that David enjoyed, with names like the Log Cabin or Babe's Blue Ox Tavern, or giant triangular signs out front advertising surf and turf specials on Tuesdays. Inside, David would order them both banana pie and Coca-Cola, a combination that always made the waitress laugh, and then inquire after her name, and then woo her, asking her what they should see and do that weekend, leaving an outstanding tip. The cabin itself had ceilings of light unfinished pine and old oak furniture, and it smelled dusty and warm inside, like an attic or a library. There she would read and swim and play card games for hours, and breathe in the sharp earthen smell of the forest that surrounded her. And in the evening, there was cocktail hour on the porch. Lemonade for Ada, in a funny glass with a trout on it. And in the nighttime, there was a chorus of bullfrogs that David would imitate while he turned off every light in the house, one after another. "Good night, good night," he would croak along with them. "Good night to you all." Over the water, from Ada's snug bedroom, from her tightly made twin bed, she could see the moon reflected on the water, a glimmering pathway from the shoreline to the distant sky. The next morning was a Saturday, and Ada woke with a resolution. It was time, she thought, to confront David, or at the very least, to try. She looked out the window. The day was gray. It looked as if a cold front had moved through. Outside, a neighbor girl was raking her front yard in a snowsuit. Ada got dressed as quickly as she could. She put on 2 sweaters. Then she left. It was her good luck that nobody was downstairs, and walked down the street to her old house. She had an idea. A prop she could use to assist her in her inquisition, something that might jog his memory. She unlocked the kitchen door. Inside, it was chilly and damp feeling, the heat at 50 degrees only to prevent the pipes from freezing in the night. She'd been visiting less because of this. Her regular diary entries into the Elixir program had slowed to 1 or 2 a week. She scanned the kitchen, as she always did, looking for anything out of place, for leaks or infestations. "We must be constant and vigilant in our war against entropy," David used to say frequently. "Entropy always has the upper hand." She still felt fiercely protective of this house. She was still happy it had not sold. The door to David's office was open, as it usually was. She had just walked past it on her way to the staircase when a shape inside it registered, and she realized someone had been sitting at his desk. She stood in place, not turning back. A chill ran up her spine. Was it David himself? Was it a ghost? An intruder? Quietly, she turned around and saw the narrow back of someone hunched over at David's computer, wearing a heavy jacket. The computer that she'd thought broken was on, glowing greenly inside the office, a bright spot that silhouetted whoever was facing it. "Who are you?" she asked bravely. She had become courageous, if nothing else, in David's absence. She felt she had no one to protect her, and so she began to act in ways she never had before. The figure stood up out of his chair swiftly, sort of defiantly, and turned to face her. It was Gregory Liston, and he stood with his hands hanging down at his sides, saying nothing. "What are you doing?" Ada said quietly. Gregory said nothing. She walked toward him, first slowly and then swiftly, feeling a rage inside her that she had rarely felt before. She wanted to drag him by his ears out of the office, but he exited before she could, walking around to the opposite side of the dining room table so that she could not get to him. She started one way and he went the other, and the two of them stood like that, facing each other for several beats. "What were you doing in there?" she asked him again, and he slowly raised his shoulders to his ears, a gesture that infuriated her further. She looked toward the computer and then walked into the office. On the screen, a window was open. It was a text file, nothing she had ever seen. It was written in David's personal code, which Ada had long ago memorized. "The unseen world," it said across the top. She read it easily. To Gregory, it must have looked like gibberish. Below it was a paragraph of text, followed by phrases that she didn't understand. Cryptic, broken phrases. Nothing that at first made sense. Her heart sped up. "What were you looking at?" she demanded.
"Nothing," said Gregory. For the first time, she heard a note of fear in his voice.
"How did you turn it on? It's broken," she said.
"I fixed it," he said simply.
He turned his palms upward toward the sky as if to say, "Easy." It infuriated Ada further. On the desk was a pad of white stationery from the lab with someone else's handwriting on it. Gregory's. A pen lay cast off to the side. On the notepad, he had written down half of the string of letters before him on the screen. "You're an idiot," Ada said cruelly, finally turning to look at him. "Were you trying to decrypt that? You never will," she said. "What an idiot," she said again for good measure, to make sure that he knew. Gregory was wearing a puffy brown parka that was built for a teenager, salt-stained from the previous winter, probably a hand-me-down from William. Only the tips of his fingers stuck out of the openings at the wrist. His skinny neck jutted up from a too large collar. His lips were painfully chapped, and he licked them, as if about to respond. "He's smarter than you," said Ada. "I'm smarter than you. I broke that code that you keep on your computer." Gregory looked at her, the color draining from his face. "Next time, try something more complicated than alphanumeric substitution," Ada told him, feeling powerful and vengeful and unkind. "I solved it in 5 seconds. I read it all." A lie. Gregory winced. The image of him being collared by a big kid in the hallway at Queen of Angels presented itself to her suddenly. He always sat alone at lunch, his face buried in a science fiction novel or a comic book. She had never once seen him walking side by side with anyone else at school. He turned abruptly and walked toward the kitchen, leaving behind the scrap of paper he had begun to write on. "Stay out of this house," Ada shouted after him with finality. "It's not your house. It's David and it's mine." I was trying to help," he said on his way out. He stammered as he said it. He was in the kitchen, on the other side of the wall, and he sounded uncertain, as if he were asking himself a question.
as if he were on the verge of tears. It was only after he left that she allowed herself, momentarily, to be impressed that he had gotten into the computer at all. She had thought it irreparable without David's guidance. She had never been able to fix it herself. She sat down in David's chair. For a long while after Gregory left, she stared at the computer screen. At the top of the document Gregory had left open was a paragraph, disguised in David's code. "We have learned that the exploration of the external world by the methods of physical science leads not to a concrete reality, but to a shadow world of symbols, beneath which those methods are unadapted for penetrating. Feeling that there must be more behind, we return to our starting point in human consciousness, the one center where more might become known. There we find other stirrings, other revelations, true or false, than those conditioned by the world of symbols. Are not these too of significance? We can only answer according to our own conviction, for here reasoning fails us altogether. A. S. Eddington." Below it were three more phrases: "Ivan Sutherland, Sword of Damocles, Elixir's House." She wrote down the paragraph and the three phrases that followed on a scrap of paper that Gregory had left behind. Then she folded the page in quarters and put it into her right pocket. "This text, the 4 ADA disc, the train ticket to Washington, these items now constituted what she considered to be her only clues. She would protect them carefully. She would keep them all together on the top shelf of her closet at Liston's house, tucked inside the pages of the dictionary. Finally, she went upstairs to David's room to retrieve what she had originally come for. It was the family portrait in David's dresser, the one she had gazed upon so many times, searching for answers about her own past. It was the David she knew in that picture, almost without question. Same posture, same nose, same half-bemused expression as he stared into the lens. But if Ellen Palmer had been telling the truth, the people behind him were not, apparently, Sibelius's. Who they were remained to be seen. For the first time in a month, Ada walked over the bridge to the bus stop and waited for the bus that would take her to Quincy. In her mittened hand, she carried the portrait. Several other people joined her. It was a gray, blustery day, almost unbearable when the wind blew. Ada turned up the collar of her coat and sank her chin down into it. On the bus, she wondered what David would look like. Would he remember her? Or in her absence, would he have forgotten her completely, erased her from his mind, overwritten her with something entirely different? At St. Andrew's, after signing in, she walked down the two long hallways toward her father's room, and then knocked lightly at the door, slightly ajar, before entering. When she did, she saw only the crown of his head over the top of his armchair. Just as he had been the last time she'd seen David, he was turned toward the window that faced the harbor, and he was motionless. His roommate Paul was lying on his bed, asleep. It was late morning. Ada walked toward her father, afraid to startle him, afraid of whom she would find. "Hello," she said, but there was no response. She circled around to the front, holding her breath. There in the armchair was David. She was relieved to find that he did not look so different after all. Thinner, yes, smaller in general, but David nonetheless. The staff at St. Andrew's took good care of him. Somebody shaved his thin cheeks. Somebody combed what little hair he had. He had one hand on each arm of the chair, and he lifted the right one as if in greeting. "Hi, David,"
she said again. It's me. It's Ada.
I've been waiting for you, said David unexpectedly. His eyes were roomier than they had been the last time she'd visited. They seemed to her to be a lighter blue.
I know, said Ada, with a certain amount of relief. I'm sorry.
David raised and lowered his eyebrows, sort of skeptically. Then he shifted his gaze once more to the window.
How have you been?
Asked Ada. Here and there, said David. For heaven's sake.
Have you been eating?
Oh, yes, said David.
Ada sat down on the bed across from him. She was still chilled from the air outside. She did not take her jacket off. David raised a hand to his head, touched it with an open palm, patted his brow lightly. How much she longed for his old self in that moment. She could feel the wish inside her, a hummingbird. If he would stand up from his chair, if he would simply stand up and walk with her out of that place and back to their old life in Boston. Instead, she produced the portrait she had been keeping tucked inside her pocket. She looked at it herself for a moment, studying the boy in the picture, then looking up at her father. There was no doubt, she thought, that this was David.
I want to ask you something, said Ada.
She stood up, knelt down in front of his chair, held the picture out so he could see it. He shifted his cloudy eyes downward without moving his head. Who are they?
Asked Ada, pointing to the adults in the picture. Well, that's Mother and Dad, said David.
But what are their names? Asked Ada.
Oh, for heaven's sake, said David. Mother and Dad.
He studied the picture again, and then reached toward it, tracing the faces with one finger. There was that accent again, the one she could not place. It was not David's accent, not his voice.
Where's Susan?
David asked suddenly. Susan? Asked Ada.
Susan, he said,
looking up at her suddenly, as if addressing her directly.
Susan, there you are. I've been waiting for you.
What's your name? Asked Ada, and he held her gaze for what seemed like quite a while.
Come on, you know it, Suze, he said at last.
What's your name?
Harold Kennedy,
said David, and he held one finger to his chest. Then he pointed one finger at her slowly.
And you're Susan Kennedy. I missed you, David said,
his light eyes filling completely with tears. Gently, surely, he bent back the brown weathered mat that surrounded the portrait, and from it removed the photograph itself, as if to inspect it more closely. And for the first time she saw what had been beneath it. There, in the bottom right corner, in a curling hand-drawn white script, five words. The Strauss Studio, Olathe, Kansas.
2009, San Francisco. Ada had slept for an hour, maybe less, when she woke up panicked, thinking she had missed her alarm. She grabbed for the phone on her nightstand, 5:59 a.m. The alarm would sound in a minute. Briefly, she lay her head back on her pillow. Her neighbors had played beer pong until 4 o'clock in the morning. How, she wondered, did they get up for work in the morning? She showered and dressed. She chose her outfit carefully, something that would read as simultaneously young and powerful.
a blazer and close-fitting dress pants. She would get to work a little early, go through the presentation one last time with Tom Chin. She ran through the people who would be at the table with them, three members of the board. The CEO, Bill Bielhoff, about a dozen potential investors who had been courted for months, and the VP of marketing, Meredith Krantz. Like many of Tritech's newer employees, Meredith was improbably young for her title, 29, perhaps, or 30 at most, and impeccably dressed. She wore brands with names that baffled Ada.
"This is Acne,"
Ada had heard Meredith saying once to a colleague about a jacket she was wearing. And Ada Googled the brand name to make sure she had heard it correctly. It had been Meredith Krantz's idea for the investors to interact at the meeting with the new product's male and female avatars. This was the idea that had kept Tom and Ada up late the night before, troubleshooting, fixing glitches. Meredith had written the script for the reps herself. She had insisted on letting them pitch the product.
"It's more dynamic," she had said, when Ada raised concerns. "And afterward, we can let the investors interact with the reps themselves," she continued.
An even worse idea, thought Ada. But Bielhoff had sided with Meredith, and Ada had done as he wished. The pitch felt to Ada like a joke. She had trouble not laughing herself when she saw the reps earnestly moving their computer-rendered limbs about in clumsy cardboard arcs. Computer-animated people in 2009 still looked stilted and bizarre. These avatars were not close to passably human. The way they used their arms was incorrect. They hovered in the air unrealistically, never dropping to meet their flanks. When reps moved, their gait was outlandishly wrong. For decades, computer animators struggled to replicate the motions of walking and running without much success. The particular rhythm of the human stride eluded them all, the rhythm of bone and muscle and fat and nerve impulse. Worse than that, these particular reps kept freezing. And at the end of the night, Tom claimed to have everything running smoothly, but Ada was still nervous. To her, having reps pitch the product only served to reinforce how far away Tritech was from being able to actually bring it to market. 5 years, 10 years until the hardware was available, maybe more. They would all have to hope for very patient and reasonably young investors. In the car at 6:45 a.m., her phone rang. It was a 617 number. She rarely got calls from Boston anymore. She remembered abruptly the conversation she had had with Connor and Caleb the night before. Someone had been by to see her. They had given this person her number, whoever it was. A man, they'd said. Could it be him? She contemplated answering for too long. Normally, she didn't answer calls from unknown numbers, but she thought perhaps she should pick this one up. By the time she had decided to, it was too late. The call had gone to voicemail. She waited for 30 seconds, then a minute, but no message had been left. When she arrived in the office, it was both unusually full and unusually quiet. Bill Bielhoff, the CEO, had tried hard to keep the investment meeting under wraps, especially around the more junior programmers. They knew the company was imperiled, surely, and it wasn't good for morale to raise and lower their hopes too much. Bielhoff, who'd been brought in by the original co-founders of the company to head the Altera initiative, was now the only Tritech employee who'd been working there longer than Ada, and the only Tritech employee to have an office door. Doors in general were not part of Tritech's culture. While other tech companies were going remote, Tritech had hung on tenaciously to its physical space. It occupied the top two floors of a building that now, nearly a third vacant in the wake of the closure of several startups in a row, felt something like post-Gold Rush California. The main level was set up like an atrium or a piazza, with six Dorian columns stretching from glossy floor to vaulted ceiling, and two walls of windows. A dome at the top of the building sported an oculus in its center that let in a dramatic, slowly rotating shaft of light. The VPs, including Ada, had their own offices around the perimeter of the main floor.
but they were doorless, open to the rest of the space. The other employees spent their days out in the open, at temporary workstations or on couches. They were given breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Hot meals rolled out on carts that locked into place at one end of the main floor. They were given healthy snacks throughout the day. Sometimes it felt to Ada a little like what preschool must have felt like, though she couldn't be sure. There were even two small dark offices with cots inside them, in case a midday nap was required by an employee who had recently pulled an all-nighter. She walked across the floor to Bielhoff's office and found the door closed. She wanted to let him know about what she and Tom had done the night before, and in the 2 hours before the meeting began. She rehearsed it in her head. She would assure him that the rep seemed now to be behaving. She would run through the backup plan they'd enact in case they didn't. She rapped lightly at the door, and Bill Bielhoff opened it after a beat.
Ada, he said, I'm glad to see you. Come in.
He was a good-looking man, tall, light-haired, straight up and down. He was slightly older than Ada. Rumors placed him at 44, but his actual age was a closely kept secret. 5 years ago, when Altera was booming, he'd been a Silicon Valley celebrity. He had been profiled in every major magazine in the country. He'd appeared in cartoon form on The Simpsons. He'd given a TED Talk. Now, even with the company in decline, he had not lost the persona he had acquired in those years, that of mischievous boy genius, pioneer, free thinker. Despite the firm's troubles, Bielhoff's estimation of himself remained unshaken. Ada had as little interaction with him as she could manage. He liked her, she thought, because she had never given him a reason not to. Other employees, ones who were closer to him, cycled in and out of his favor rapidly and randomly. She watched them sometimes, shaken, walking out of his office with their heads low.
Have a seat, said Bielhoff,
and she did, and so did he.
Everything looking good?
He asked her. She nodded. I think so, she said, and he said, great. The demo was glitching a little bit last night, but I think we've got it under control, she began. Bielhoff didn't look interested.
Listen, Ada, he said.
He took a breath. Yes, said Ada.
I've been talking with some board members. We're letting Meredith run the meeting today.
Ada paused. Meredith Krantz? She asked dumbly.
Yeah.
As in, said Ada.
We're turning it over to her. We think she's got it. We think she'll be good.
Ada opened and closed her mouth. But, she said.
I know you and Tom have been working on the pitch for a while, said Bielhoff, and that's great. But the fact is that none of the investors we have coming to sit in today knows anything about programming, and we think Meredith will do a good job of packaging it for them.
What if they have questions?
I have faith that Meredith can answer them, said Bielhoff, or else I'll be there too.
Bill had been a programmer once upon a time, but he hadn't worked on the tech side of the firm in years. It wouldn't have surprised Ada if he'd forgotten most of what he once knew. Certainly he knew none of what had gone into the beginnings of the new project. You don't even want us to sit in? Ada said. Just to be safe? Bielhoff stuck out his bottom lip, blew upward. A small lock of hair shifted slightly on his forehead. She pictured him suddenly as a rep. How might one animate that particular motion? That particular expression?
I think you might make Meredith nervous, he said, in a tone of voice that told her he was trying to be kind.
Ada lifted a hand and dropped it onto the arm of the chair she was sitting in. She put her hands on her knees. She leaned forward, stood up. I guess that's that, she said. She wondered briefly, perhaps unfairly, whether Meredith was sleeping with him. It wouldn't be the first time that Bielhoff had dated an employee.
You're appreciated, Ada, said Bielhoff. I hope you know that.
Ada nodded once. She walked toward the door. She looked down at the shoes she had chosen for the day. Heels. She never wore heels.
A thought occurred to her then, and she turned to face Bielhoff before she left. "The name," she said. "Does Meredith know where the name comes from?"
"Of course," said Bielhoff, but he had already lifted his phone to make a call, and he looked at Ada as if waiting for her to leave.
The name of the program was The Unseen World, the UW for short. And the truth was that no one except for Ada knew how it had come to be called that. She had suggested it, the others had approved. She had never shared the story of its provenance. She walked dumbfounded toward her doorless office. Around her, heads popped over workstation walls. Did the rest of the company know already? Meredith Krantz was friends with some of them. Halfway across the floor, she ran into Tom Chin, who looked at her grimly. "You too?" said Ada. He nodded, lifted his shoulders once, dropped them. Ada sat at her desk for a while, uncertain of what to do next. She felt almost as if she should go home for the day. It was too much, she thought, to watch a series of investors walk past her office on their way to the meeting room, to watch Meredith walk toward her fate. What would she do, Ada wondered, if the reps didn't cooperate?
What would Bill do?
He was both impulsive and stubborn. 10 years ago, when fate had been working in his favor, these were the traits that had propelled him into glory. Now these were the traits that threatened to tank the entire company. She didn't notice she was holding her phone until it vibrated in her hand. She glanced at it. It was the same 617 number that had called earlier that morning. This time, she answered it. The person on the other end hesitated long enough that she nearly hung up. "Ada?" he said at last. It was a voice she hadn't heard in half a decade. 1980s. Boston.
"I need help," said Ada, breathless. She was pink from the cold. Her nose was running. She was standing in front of Miss Holmes at the Fields Corner Public Library branch. She was panting audibly. She had run too fast from the bus stop.
"Are you all right, Ada?"
said Miss Holmes, looking concerned.
"Can you help me find something?"
"Of course," she said, but she looked down at her watch.
"But it's 1:55, dear."
On Saturdays, the library closed at 2 p.m.
"I," said Ada, and then wondered how she could possibly convey to Miss Holmes the urgency of the situation.
She stood silently for a moment, mustering her courage.
"Tell you what," said Miss Holmes kindly. "Just sit right here a moment. I'll be right back."
She gestured to a low table. Gratefully, Ada sat, and she watched as Miss Holmes made her rounds, leaning over to encourage the patrons to finish what they were doing, in her low librarian voice. Then she returned to her post to check out their books. Ada looked at the picture she was still clutching in her hands. "Olathe, Kansas. Harold Kennedy, C-A-N-A-D-Y, or C-A-N-A-D-E-E. Susan Kennedy," the words knocked around inside her, bitter in their foreignness, somehow unsavory. She didn't know how to pronounce the word Olathe. She didn't know how Kennedy was spelled. When the last patron had left, Miss Holmes turned the sign on the front door from open to closed, and then returned to Ada's side.
"Now, dear," she said, "what can I help you with?"
And Ada, at last, confessed to Miss Holmes everything that she knew, managing to do so with a blank, impartial face, trying to imagine how David might have done it. Clinically, forthrightly. Miss Holmes, to her credit, did not betray much shock, though surely she must have been dismayed, not only for Ada, but perhaps for herself. She murmured from time to time sympathetically. She put a hand on Ada's forearm at the mention of David's disease, and she left it there comfortingly.
"Oh,
Ada, she said, when Ada had finished speaking and was looking stiffly down at the table in front of her.
And what is that you're holding? She asked.
I don't know, said Ada. It might be a picture of his real family. David's, or Harold's, I guess.
It made her flinch. The thought that not even his name, not even the word that she had spoken so many thousands or millions of times in her life, the word that meant to her father, was correct. David was gone, but also David was gone, replaced with something cold and uncanny.
And it's from a place called Olathe, said Ada, spending two syllables on the name.
Olathe, said Miss Holmes, if I'm not mistaken. She wore glasses on a chain about her neck, and she held them up to her eyes now to look.
Oh, that's him, she said, with something like fondness about the boy in the picture. Isn't it?
Ada nodded. Against her will, she still loved the picture. She had always been fascinated by it as a piece of evidence that her father had once, improbably, been a child.
Where would you like to begin? Asked Miss Holmes.
There were two steps to be taken, they decided. The first was looking up further information on the Sibeliuses themselves, in the society pages of old editions of the New York Times on microfilm, for example, said Miss Holmes. That might be a good place to start. If they could find more information about the real David Sibelius and his parents, they might find some explanation, some connection to Ada's father. And the second was finding historical records and newspaper articles about any Kennedy family in Olathe.
Only those would be much more difficult to find, said Miss Holmes, because it was quite unlikely that any library in Boston would have old editions of their local paper on microfilm.
And I'm not quite sure I'm up for a trip to Kansas, said Miss Holmes. How about you?
Therefore, she called information and requested the number of the public library there.
The main branch, I guess, she said to the operator.
Oh, that branch then, she said a moment later. She was standing behind the checkout counter. While she waited, she inspected her glasses. She inspected the piece of paper in her hand, on which Ada had written down the names Harold Kennedy, Susan Kennedy, spelling them the way she had heard them, as they had been pronounced by David hours before.
Yes, hello, Miss Holmes said suddenly, and she introduced herself and her occupation, and she explained the information she was looking for, and she left her name and number, both for the library and, Ada noted, for her home telephone.
Thanks very much, said Miss Holmes. I would so appreciate anything you can find, and I'm happy to return the favor any time.
Then, hanging up the phone, Miss Holmes turned back to Ada.
I'm afraid I have to go home now, dear, she said. But let's continue this on Monday, after your school day, shall we?
Ada walked back to Liston slowly. Dorchester was busy that day. Mothers out grocery shopping, their hands tied up with bags and children, teenagers kicking rocks down the sidewalk, shouting to one another across Dot Avenue. Ada was brimming with a sort of energy that did not have an outlet. New information, new ideas, new emotions that she could not articulate to anyone. She had already made up her mind not to tell Liston what David had said. This was a part of the puzzle she wanted to figure out for herself. She did not want to think of him as Harold Kennedy. She wanted her father to still be David for as long as he could be. She wanted everyone else to still think of him as such. Most of the Listons were home when she arrived back at the house, but Liston herself was out. The familiar, slightly artificial smell of the house presented itself to her, and it occurred to her that it had begun to replace the musty warmth of David's house as the smell of home. Maddie was in the den watching television. From upstairs, she heard Melanie's high, breathy voice and William's low one. But everything was still. In the kitchen, she made herself a sandwich from what Liston kept on hand, Wonder Bread, turkey,
American cheese, Miracle Whip, and brought it upstairs to her room to eat. Moments after she sat down at her desk, there was a light knock at her door.
"Hello?"
said Ada, mid-bite. The door opened slightly. In the crack between it and the threshold, Ada saw two eyes peering toward her. Gregory.
"What do you want?"
she asked unkindly. She was still incensed from that morning. What right did he have, she thought again, to be on David's computer? She felt an angry surge in her pulse again. What right did he have to set one foot in their house?
Can I come in for a sec?
Gregory asked.
Why?
Said Ada.
Just for a sec,
said Gregory. And without waiting for permission, he entered the room. He looked shifty and nervous. He stood facing her, folded his hands in front of him, looked down at the floor. Then he mumbled something too quiet to be heard.
I can't hear you,
said Ada. It occurred to her for the first time that she sounded like the girls she had become friends with at Queen of Angels, that the stress and intonation of her voice had begun to mimic theirs. She said like now, with some frequency. She said whatever.
I'm sorry, said Gregory.
For what? She said. She wanted to hear him say it.
For being in your dad's house, said Gregory.
What were you doing there? Said Ada. Had you been there before? Gregory paused, and then he nodded.
A lot?
Ada demanded.